So I am Tiffany McDowell. I am here at Adler University in Chicago, Illinois, and I direct the Institute on Social Exclusion. So we look at mental health, but we look at social determinants of mental health. And we've been working here for the past few years to look at all of the things that create barriers to access to health and wellness in our communities. And so, of course, we know through our health and all policies discussion that a lot of that has to do with our communities where we live, but then also things like education, access to employment, livable wage, transportation. So those are the things that we take on in our institute. So it'll be a little bit of a shift from the discussion about mental health clinical interventions or interventions to impact mental health. Our work really is to impact the determinants of mental health. So we'll talk about that today. I have no relationships to disclose, but we want to talk about mental health impact assessment. So just a quick show of hands, who has heard of health impact assessment? Okay, great. So this, for those of you who are not familiar, health impact assessment is basically a process that looks at the impact of non-health decisions on the impact or on the health of communities. And so at Adler, because our focus is mental health, we looked at developing a systematic process for looking at the mental health and well-being of communities. And this was important because a lot of our public health friends who had been working in health impact assessment had been, even if they incorporated mental health, they really were not looking at population level mental health. They were looking at things like stress, right? So we know that stress comes from limited access to employment or education or things like that, but they either weren't then taking that to make predictions on impact, or they were adding it to their lit review, or basically saying, we know that mental health just in general is going to be impacted, but they weren't really saying or reporting on how they thought that was going to happen. So we decided to take this on and try to look at both physical and mental health. So this is the process. We looked at public decisions, how they impact the social determinants, so how where we are born, grow, live, work, and age, and then that the impacts of those on physical and mental health outcomes, and try to make predictions and recommendations for our decision makers. So it's a six-step process, and that is based on the HIA practice standards, which there are several versions of that. I gave a citation. You can check that out if you have not seen. But the key part here is not just doing the assessment, which a lot of people hear impact assessment and you think it's an assessment. It goes a step beyond just collecting the data, but we really, the key part of this is creating recommendations that then go to decision makers that shift or change what the decision is. So you want to try to get out in front of a decision. You want to try to impact the decision maker on the basis of mitigating negative physical and mental health outcomes, and then being supportive of wellness. And that is the piece that really, that excites me. So, and as I said, the main objective of our work was to create a more rigorous and comprehensive approach to health impact assessment. And one of the reasons why is what you've heard, and Dr. Snowden talked about this, about the huge challenge that we are facing about mental illness and the morbidity and mortality, not just here in the US, but across the world. So it's key for us to try to do prevention today so that we don't have to look at this in future generations. And then we also know that mental health is such a key mechanism through which the social determinants impact our physical health too. So like I talked about stress, but we think about things like neighborhood violence, stress hormones, things like teen pregnancy, and infant mortality and low birth weight babies have all been linked to mental illness, depression, anxiety. But then look at all the other things that are tied together. So chronic and concentrated poverty, cardiovascular and infectious diseases are also linked to and interconnected to depression, anxiety, stress, and allostatic load. So As I said earlier, our health impact practitioners before this time had not really looked at the interactions between physical and mental health, or they had largely ignored mental health or mental illness. So we wanted to make sure that that was incorporated and that there was a model to be followed. So the team, this was led by folks at the Institute on Social Exclusion. We also were supported by Adler students, faculty, and staff. But then we had to partner with our residents and leaders in Chicago's Inglewood community. So here locally, Inglewood is located on the southwest side. It's a primarily African-American community. It has a lot of great organizations, but there are a lot of demographic and social challenges that we know we face here. But we were able to pull together a great team of 16 different organizations that partnered with us to guide this work. And we were also funded by RWJF, Kellogg, and the Pierce Family Foundation, which is a local foundation here. So we started to look, because we had this wide-ranging team of advisors, we looked at what are some of the challenges that the Inglewood community face. And they talked about, you know, jobs as being one of the major challenges and areas or social determinants that they thought impacted mental health and well-being. So we looked at a number of policies, and if you are familiar with HIA, you create a screening list of all the potential policies that you think you could potentially impact. So one of the main ones that came up was Illinois State Bill 1284, which was going to amend the current law at that time on the employer use of arrest records in making employment decisions. That bill was subsequently withdrawn by the sponsors. So as we were in the middle of doing this health impact assessment, they pulled it, which was like, expletive, right? So luckily, because we had such great partnerships, we had a policy advisor at the Safer Foundation, which is a local organization that works with folks reentering society from prison. They were able to give us a heads up that the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission was about to revise their policy guidance on use of arrest records. So that allowed us to, you know, continue the work and actually have an impact on a federal level. So that was exciting. So we, as I said, we created this collaborative network and partnership with folks to make sure that we were able to hear their voice on what was most important to Inglewood residents. And then we co-developed the initial question for our inquiry, which was, what would be the impact on the mental health of the community when an employer uses arrest records in making employment decisions about members of that community? So as I said, we started with the state bill, and then we were able to go toward the federal policy guidance for our level of inquiry. And the one of the more important pieces here is that with health impact assessment and mental health impact assessment, we shifted the unit of analysis from working and studying community or residents to studying a policy and studying how that policy would then impact the people. So that allowed our community partners to be the researchers with us, and that helped to shift the power away from feeling like they're study participants or being researched, which we heard a lot from people, that they felt like they didn't want to be, you know, guinea pigs all the time. So I shared that Inglewood was a community. What made this a perfect community to look at for this particular study was the fact that over a four-year period, District 7, which includes Inglewood and West Inglewood, recorded more than 65,000 arrests, and there's only 70,000 people in that district, right? So that's a little more than a one-to-one ratio of residents to arrest. And we know that some people are having multiple arrests. But what was also interesting was that only about 45% of those arrests ever made it to a conviction. So that means that a lot of people are having arrests hanging on their records, which were then still denying them employment. So that made it really crucial for us to look at employment and the barriers to employment because of arrest records for this community. So just quickly, this is the pathway diagram that we sketched out as a part of scoping out the project. So if you can see, we start at the left with the policy decision, and then we move to the proximal social determinant. So we said, of course, that the policy should impact employment and employability. But then, of course, because we are looking at social exclusion, that's our focus, we thought that employment would impact the amount of social exclusion that people would feel or experience, which would then lead to, changes or impacts to their income, the neighborhood conditions, and then that would lead to both impacts to community-level mental health as well as individual mental health and well-being. So, and I think that's important to note because to that point, there had been no health impact assessments that looked at both community level as well as individual level mental health and mental illness. So you can see we had a number of different data collection strategies. We used existing data. We also collected our own data through quantitative and qualitative means. We pulled a lot of evidence through existing literature and research. So some of the quantitative analyses that we did, we were able to do structural equation modeling. So we looked and found that arrest history did influence the stability of household income, which makes sense, right? But then also that income instability influenced mental health outcomes. And then the social exclusion or experience of social exclusion and the stability of household income were related. So it's all common sense, right? This isn't like groundbreaking. But what we found was that the number of times that an individual had been arrested was directly related to their mental health outcomes through their mutual association with all of those major social determinants. So because their income levels were unstable, because their neighborhood experienced such high levels of disorganization, that was the way that their arrest record was tied to their mental health outcomes. And so similarly, we collected qualitative data, and we looked at the influence of arrest and employment and arrest on individual and community mental health. And we also were able to talk to and interview employers for their knowledge of the policy as well as their understanding of how their own practices would change if the policy changed. And we heard from a lot of I think 7 out of the 11 said that they wouldn't change their practices. They would still basically discriminate or use arrest records before thinking about hiring someone. As we heard from one employer, I don't want to hire a murderer. And so even when we educated them further to say, well, an arrest doesn't equal guilt or conviction, they were like, so it's still a process. We need to make sure that we're keeping ourselves safe. So that's something that directly goes against what the policy is for, right? So a few of the outputs, we were able to have open houses, town hall meetings in the community to educate them about their rights as well as what the policy said, because like many of us didn't even know that the policy existed and what our rights are. But then we also did things to engage the community, like developing videos. We did infographics so that we took our report and boiled it down to an easily digestible form. Then one of the fun and more interactive things we did was we connected with one of the EEOC commissioners via Twitter. And so she came to Chicago and we held a summit where she talked about the value of doing this kind of work and educating and engaging community residents to impact policies and decisions. So some of the outcomes, we did develop the findings and recommendations, but I think if you jump down to the last bullet, this is the key point for me, is that the community was able to develop their capacity to do this work with us. So they were the ones that collected the data, they were the ones that did the interviewing of the employers, and so now they were able to develop their own strategies to take this data and move it to advocacy. So if you've heard a lot, most states now are moving to the ban the box, right? So they use this data that we collected to inform local and state level policy change. So we were able to resurrect, or I shouldn't say resurrect, but create another state bill, which we had an executive order in 2013 that came through that current governor, or the governor at that time, as well as another bill that came out the following year that effectively banned the box. So that was in 2014. So we were very proud of that. And then here locally in Chicago, there was already an ordinance for city workers to not be asked about their criminal records. So then in 2014, that ordinance was expanded to all private employers as well. So that was very exciting. And I don't know if you all have just heard, but President Obama is, you're shaking your head. So yeah, so we're excited. And so I'm not gonna claim that that was a direct result of our work, but I'm not gonna deny it either. So we're excited about this. And you know, the one thing that I must say is that we want to make sure that people, if you are a practitioner, or if you are a researcher, if you have access to data or communities, think about joining with us and Sophia, and try to, you know, think about how to use your work and move it to policy and systems change. So thank you. You can visit our website for more information about the study itself. Sure. So I'll even start by saying that we had a community engagement coordinator that lived in Englewood, lived and worked there for all her life. And so she was able to get us in, and we could not open the door. She just knew people and was able to get us in to even talk to these employers. And so several of them said, you know, when we asked about their knowledge of the guidance, most people said no, or they had heard something, or they knew some parts of it, but they didn't know that it extended to arrest, not just convictions, and that the policy is actually stronger on arrest. So the policy has been around since 1990. And that's why the EEOC decided to have stronger enforcement for the guidance. But we heard a lot that they excluded people on the basis of their criminal record because they wanted to feel safe. They wanted to feel as though they were creating an environment for their customers as well as themselves, so there wouldn't be the risk of loss, of course. But then they also said, which was interesting, I didn't include this, that some of the employers said they did not want to hire people from the whole community of Englewood, regardless of their criminal background. So that was interesting to us. So then the flip side was that some of the employers said that they would hire people if someone else could vouch for them. So one of the recommendations we made to our community partners was that if they could create some sort of buddy system or some way that you could, you know, give a referral for someone who may have a criminal background that you're trying to help, or, you know, and that employers in the area would actually be educated about how to work with that and to make sure that they have a personal connection. Because we heard that a lot from actually most of the employers that said that they would value that.
But if you're black and have a
Mm-hmm. Right. And so our goal wasn't necessarily to duplicate research. It was really to see what would help employers to move to want to incorporate something into their practices, and then how can we educate them? So when we heard that they weren't even aware, that's how we ended up having the summit later on that engaged the EEOC commissioner, because that was our way to connect with the business community, employers, HR managers, and also the Chamber of Commerce here, so that people can understand this is a bigger issue than just, you know, one community. We wanted to make sure that others were aware that you're violating folks' civil rights and their human rights and their dignity. Thank you.